Hey everybody, it's Britt, lead pastor at Sunridge. Welcome back to our teaching podcast. You know, we are on a mission here at Sunridge to help people find and follow Jesus. We believe in the good news that Jesus welcomes all, regardless of how far you feel from God. That means we're a great starting point to explore Christianity or to sink your spiritual roots deep as a devoted Jesus follower. If you'd like to know more about us, just check out our website at sunridgechurch.org. And of course, we'd love to have you drop in anytime for a visit to learn and worship along with us. And now, here's our teaching for this week.
Some of you may know me. I've spoken here on a number of occasions. My wife, Jenny, and our four girls have been in Temecula since 2017, and we've been a part of this church since that time. I've had the opportunity... Oh, thank you. I had the opportunity and the privilege to serve as an elder for about 5 years, and that's been such a joy. We love being a part of this church. Oh, you can sit down, or just stand, whatever you want. Either one's fine. And so, we've had the opportunity to be a part of this church for a long time. Before that, I was a missionary for 23 years, most of that overseas and most of that in Muslim countries. We moved back to the States as our children were getting older for schooling opportunities and so forth, and ended up opening a recruiting business back in 2014. And if you've heard me speak before, you may remember that I love history and I love space. And so if it's space history, even better. And so I remember as a child watching the Apollo missions, one particular, so I have a twin brother, and I have this burned into my memory, and it may have been because it was one of the more tragic Apollo missions. We're sitting there in our high chairs, and I think we were eating waffles. And it's back in those days where the TV looks like it's about the size of a deep freeze. And we're sitting there watching it, and I remember kind of these grainy gray images. And if you've followed the Apollo missions over the years and what the space race was happening in the U.S., it was pretty much a reaction to what the Soviets were doing. And I was watching a documentary a month or two ago on Apollo 11. And what had preceded Apollo 11 in 1969 was a lot of tragedy, both on the Soviet side and the American side. Death, fires in the cabin. And I'll bring up, if you don't mind, bring up this photo. This is actually from the documentary. Granted, it's a little grainy. It's the olden days. And I'm taking a photo of a video, so that's why. But if you'll see the astronauts coming out, there's a guy in the forefront of the photo in a full fire suit. You can see, you probably can't really see it, but he's got a fire extinguisher in his hand. And so as the astronauts are coming out, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, and they're in the elevator with this guy, they're not thinking, dude, what are you doing? Why do you have this funny get-up on? They knew full well what they were getting into based on what had happened in the last 2 to 8 years, both in the Soviet Union and in the U.S. And you can take that off. One of the expectations, literally, was death. And so they knew what they were getting into before they even got off that elevator, which actually contrasts pretty dramatically what we're getting into today. Because what Jesus says in this passage in Mark 8 is really unexpected. And so we're continuing a series in discipleship and following Jesus that we've been doing for about 6 to 8 weeks. And so let's go ahead and take a look at this passage from Mark 8. And I'll read it here. It says, "Then he," Jesus, "called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, 'If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man gain in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels.'" Now, I'll admit, that's pretty heavy stuff. That's a really sobering passage that Jesus threw out to the people in the audience. And before I unpack this, I actually wanted to back up a little bit and have us consider the audience that is receiving this message. And generally speaking, and you can bring up this next slide, generally speaking, there's three groups of people that are more often than not and very frequently mentioned in Scripture that just kind of circulate around Jesus. And of course we know disciples and there's certain women. He always mentions these certain women that are with him and of course the disciples. And those are the people that know, love Jesus, they've heard his teaching, and they, generally speaking, they've accepted his teaching. The other group that you may be familiar with is the Pharisees and religious leaders. And I made it red to make it easy because they're usually the ones that are at odds with Jesus. So they're often in contention with not only what Jesus is doing, but what Jesus is saying. And a lot of his woes and his admonitions are against them. But then you have a third group, and it's this. And they're always around, and it's the crowds. And they're just kind of there. They're neutral, so to speak. They're curious. They're wondering, okay, who's this Jesus guy about? And they just kind of listen to what he has to say. They may maybe want to see kind of like a sideshow. Is he going to heal someone? And so those are generally in Scripture the people you see following Jesus and around Jesus all the time. And so bring up this next slide if you don't mind. And this is actually a picture of Galilee. And so I imagine, you know, there's the sea in the background. There's kind of a slope down. To me, I mean, I can't say for sure Jesus was here, but, you know, it very likely could have been where he's passing by. He sees, you know, disciples or people mending their nets. He calls his disciples, or maybe he's, you know, standing near the tree, broadcasting a sermon to the crowds, the disciples, and everyone else. And it just seems like a really natural spot for Jesus to be doing his ministry. And so as we're looking at our passage today in Mark 8, let me give you a really brief recap of what came before. And I'm not going to get into this, but I just want us to see what came before the passage we just read in Mark 8. So it's just bullet points, nothing fancy. So here's what it is. So in chapter 8, right before this passage, Jesus expresses and actually verbalizes compassion for the crowd that's around him. He feeds thousands of people, but then right after that, again, the Pharisees, they're chiding him. They're wanting to test him. They're wanting to kind of, you know, stick in his craw. And then he warns his disciples about the Pharisees because of who they are, what they do, and their basically heretical teaching. He heals a blind man. Then Peter confesses that Jesus is the Christ or the Messiah. Jesus then predicts his death and his rejection. And he's like, hey, just so you'll know, to manage your expectations, I'm about to be rejected, tortured, and killed. And so Peter rebukes him. He's like, Peter pulls him over and he said, hey, you know, you don't need to be doing this. And then Jesus reprimands Satan as if Satan is saying that. So we've got this, you can pull up the next slide if you don't mind. We've got this overview of where very likely, potentially, Jesus is speaking. And so in Mark 8:34, it says, he then called the crowd to him along with his disciples. And this is your first fill in the blank. It says, Jesus challenges both the disciples and the crowds with the conditions for following him. So he's engaging both the disciples and everyone around him at the same time. This is a rhetorical question. Why is Jesus including the crowds in this message that he has today? It's a very heavy, a very direct and sobering message. Why is he including the crowds in this message? All right, let's take a look and think about the same situation, the same setting. Maybe Jesus used this location multiple times, but for sake of reference, let's pull it back up. Most of us are familiar with the Sermon on the Mount. I'll read a verse or part of a verse or two from there. You can pull that up. It says, now, When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying. So I kind of have this visual picture of, you know, Jesus is down in the green part. All the crowds are there. Maybe he just did some miracles and fed a bunch of them. He's been teaching. He's like, I'm tired. He goes and sits under the trees, and the crowd's eating their fish and loaves or whatever. And then the disciples come to Jesus, and they're just chilling in a very private, intimate moment, and he's teaching them. And when we think Sermon on the Mount, it's not a sermon to a big group of people. He's talking intimately with his disciples. And what are some of the things that Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount? Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are those who mourn, the meek, those who are persecuted for me. So, and he talks about the salt and the light. And he talks about, you know, real murder is not going out and killing someone, it's what's in your heart. Real adultery is not going out and sleeping with someone, it's what's in your heart. And so there's a key difference here, and you can bring up, or I guess you already did the slide. Jesus only addresses his disciples in the Sermon on the Mount. Why is he excluding the crowd? If he includes them in the first passage, why does he exclude them in the Sermon on the Mount? Because this is a huge difference. It's a huge contrast. All the same people are present, the crowds and the disciples, but he differentiates the message for different people. The reason today's passage about denying yourself and picking up your cross is that he is drawing a line in the sand. And so this is your next note and fill in the blank. So the crowd probably wants a free meal. They want to be healed. And there is nothing wrong with that. If I were in the same situation, who wouldn't want, you know, you got a broken leg. Oh, I did have a broken leg. Who wouldn't want to be healed? Who wouldn't want, if you're hungry, to get something to eat? There's absolutely nothing wrong with any of that. But what Jesus is doing now is drawing a line in the sand. If we look at the Sermon on the Mount, the reason the audience is different there and that he's only addressing the disciples is because they already accepted his message. He's telling the disciples, because you are my followers, because you are my children, this is what a kingdom member looks like. You're merciful, you're meek, you're a peacemaker, you follow me, you hunger and thirst after righteousness, you will be persecuted. He's telling the disciples, this is who you are. What he's doing today with both the disciples and the crowd is, as I said, he's drawing a line in the sand. And this is a huge reality check for them, for everyone listening. And so look at what he says. You can pull up the next slide. Two things are about to happen. He's going to give conditions for following him, and then he's going to explain why these conditions are necessary. And he's not even saying you have to follow him. He's not saying, hey, you need to follow me because it's better for you. He's saying, if you're going to follow me, this is what's going to have to happen, that there's going to be a tremendous amount of sacrifice on your part if you're going to be my disciple. And so two things have to precede following Jesus. And this is super important. This is key. Bring up the next slide if you don't mind. Here's what he says, and I'll repeat it. You've already heard it, but I want to emphasize it. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself. It's like, what is deny myself? What does that even mean? I don't know what that means. So let's look and see what denying yourself is not. Because sometimes it's just helpful. Okay, this is not what denying yourself means. So bring up that next slide if you don't mind. So it's not resisting specific material things. It's not asceticism like, hey, I'm going to try to live as poor as possible and give up everything and be a monk. It's not self-rejection like, oh, God made me this way, but I have to not be me. It's not self-hatred like, oh, I'm so horrible just because I'm human, I'm a worm. It's not that. And it's not even disowning of particular sins. That is not what denying yourself is. So what is denying yourself? You can bring up that next slide. It's renouncing of yourself. And it's ceasing to make you, me, us, self, the central focus of our own life and actions. And in doing so involves a fundamental reorientation of the principle of our lives, that God, not ourselves, must be the center of our life. Take a look at this. It's the next note. Denying yourself is not giving up material things. It's not self-hatred. It's placing the divine will. It's placing God's desires and his will before our own. So at this point, when the crowd heard this, deny myself, man, I was only here for the fillet of fish. And they're like, okay, you know, maybe 20, 30% of them walked away. It's like, this guy's kind of, we already thought he was kind of crazy. Yeah, he just proved it. And so a lot of people probably just said, okay, this is too much. I'm out of here. Totally normal reaction, completely expected. A lot of people may have been thinking, I can do that. Okay, I can do this. But then he says, and this is the next slide, then he called, and I'm reiterating, then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and then take up his cross. There's the idea in rabbinic teaching that, okay, there's the yoke of the Torah. As Jews, you know, whether there's Jews in, some Jews in the crowd and disciples, you know, some of them had Jewish backgrounds, like, okay, the yoke of the Torah. Yeah, obey the law. But if you're in first century Rome, that's clearly not the image that came to you. It was not the idea of the yoke of Torah. Crucifixion was a macabre, gruesome, horrific, inhumane affair. And typically when someone's sentenced to be crucified, they, and you may have seen this like in Passion of the Christ or some other movies, someone's not dragging a full cross around. It's a cross beam. So the cross beam that goes, the stake in the ground was maybe 10, 12 feet high. That stayed there on site. The cross beam, I don't know exactly where they would have put it on, but maybe where you were sentenced, if there's a courthouse, and you had to actually carry, it's probably about 5 or 6 feet in length and about 100 pounds. And it had to be a humiliating trudge to where you knew you were literally going to die. And so the next fill in the blank is that taking up our cross is a daily walk to our execution. And so at this point, the crowd's like, what in the world is this guy talking about? Like, this is way too heavy. You're getting dark. And, you know, at this point, most of the crowd may have just said, yeah, I'm not doing that at all. Because he's saying it's only after these first two conditions are met that we're ready to follow him. Denying yourself and taking up your cross. And then when we've done that, follow me. And a lot of us may be thinking, okay, I've never heard evangelism done this way before. I mean, we haven't. So as I mentioned, I was a missionary for 23 years and became a believer when I was young. I've shared my faith all over the world as a college student, in the U.S., in Europe, Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, and a lot of Muslim countries. That's typically not how we start out the gospel presentation. And, you know, usually we're thinking, okay, it's hard enough just to get up the courage to share my faith. Now you wanted me to put barriers in front of it, like, okay, you got to do this first. And let me just say, if your mom or your grandmother drug you here to church today, and you're like, what is this guy doing? This is exactly why I hate going to church. There is much better news coming. And so if you're wondering why I'm talking about this, well, Britt asked me to. No, I'm kidding. No, I volunteered. He said, hey, there's some dates, and I chose this. I'm not going to throw him under the I was going to say under the rug, but that's not the right phrase. Under the car? Under the bus. Sweep it under the rug. That's what I was, yeah. I mean, forget that. You know what I'm saying. All right, but the whole point is that you know, we do look at the gospel. It literally means in Greek, good news. It's euangelion. So if you know a Eugene, a friend, we got a cousin named Eugene. It comes from Greek, Eugene, good genes. The whole point is of Jesus' message is that it's good news. When the angel came and announced the Christmas story, behold, I bring you good news of great joy, which will be for all people. That has never changed. The good news is still there. Some of you may be familiar with different methods of evangelism. And so I know we've talked about this before, that we as Americans in Temecula in 2025, 2026, we naturally and instinctively bring our own interpretation and application to whatever we read in Scripture. And that's completely normal. It's kind of like if you saw a fish and you look down at the fish and you could talk, it's like, hey, what's it like living in the water? The fish is like, has no idea what you're talking about. That's the only lens they see life through. And so the same is true for us when we look at Scripture. So imagine if you lived in a different country and in a different time period, how that passage that Jesus shared might hit differently. Because that's really key, and that whether it's that passage or something in Romans or something in Ephesians, we have to realize that we bring a lot of color to the Scripture that can influence how we interpret it and how we apply it. So you're probably familiar with two different evangelism tools, and you may have seen these before, you may have used them before. I've used the four spiritual laws literally countless of times. So one of them is the four spiritual laws, if you don't mind bringing that up, and it has four little laws. They're not really laws, is maybe not the best word, and it's being reworked, but initially it was started, and both of these tools, by the way, I will mention, were started in like the 50s and the 60s in the U.S., so kind of a Western perspective. First law, God loves you and offers a wonderful plan for life. John 3:16, we all know that. For God so loved the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then John 10:10, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. So great. That's good news. Another one you may be familiar with is evangelism explosion. I haven't used this method as much, but it basically starts out with two questions. Do you know for sure that you are going to be with God in heaven? Very direct, especially if you don't know the person. And then, if God were to ask you, why should I let you into heaven, what would you say? So those two methods sound really different than what Jesus is saying here today. Still good news, but a very different approach. So, I was going to say you can take those down. So why do those messages sound so different? And why is there some contrast between what Jesus is saying today and what we've seen in those two different types of evangelism methods? So as I had mentioned, I was a missionary for a really long time. And I think it's helped me understand and see, especially living in different countries and especially living in Muslim countries, how those passages hit differently. So you can just bring up this next slide. So I wanted to kind of briefly share what it's like to do evangelism and to follow Jesus in the U.S. versus in Muslim countries. And obviously, I can't say, hey, I know what it's like as a former Muslim in a Muslim country to do evangelism there, nor can I say, hey, I was a former Muslim in a Muslim country, and this is what happened when I became a believer. I can't do that, and I'm not going to try to. But I can say what it's like to do evangelism in a Muslim country and to live in a Muslim country as a missionary. So there are some generalities here, but doing evangelism in the U.S., there's not a lot of pushback. There's not a lot of persecution. Of course, it happens. When I was a student, I was at a very liberal, extremely liberal college, very humanistic, Vanderbilt. In the 80s, it was definitely that way. It's almost like they tried to push the limit to how crazy can we be. We would run into obstacles as Christians. I mean, it's so ridiculous, it's kind of stupid and funny. But like, for example, I was doing some work with a group called Navigators, and we're trying to get a Bible study room set up for our, you know, a little group we had. And we went into the student union where there's a pub, they serve alcohol, and the person, the administrator, is like, oh, you can't meet in here, they serve alcohol. Well, back in Tennessee, probably like in the early 1900s, there were blue laws, that a pub or a bar can't establish itself within 100 meters or 100, I guess it's 100 feet or 100 yards, of a church. So clearly, the law was to protect the church, but they used the law to penalize us as Christians. I mean, it's kind of stupid, but you know, you run into stuff like that. But you can also, in the U.S., sometimes realize that the way evangelism is done is not always the best, and it's not real persecution when people don't like what you're doing. So I know we had had a World Vision come a number of years ago and invited us to, you know, run the marathon, LA Marathon, and you know, raise money for water. And so I started doing the LA Marathon. I try to do one marathon a year. And if you've ever been on a race course in LA, and you're locked in. I mean, you're not going anywhere unless you just quit the race. And so we're all sweating, bleeding, dying, throwing up, passing out. And then you get, every so often, it wasn't just one person, people on megaphones telling us how we're fornicating and going to hell. And I'm like, I don't think I'm fornicating. You know, I don't think I'm going to hell. And so people are flipping them off. People are, you know, cussing them out or whatever. And it's like, if that person walks away feeling justified for their evangelism and that they're being persecuted, you might need to think of a different way to do evangelism than taking a captive audience that can't do anything while you're yelling at them. And, you know, we also look at people around the U.S. doing things that are just pushing the limit as well, unconstitutionally. Hey, this may ruffle some feathers, but hear me out. Hey, you know, you need to put the Ten Commandments in the schools. Hey, I'm being persecuted because I'm trying to get the Ten Commandments in the schools. If it's unconstitutional, that's not persecution for getting pushback. If you want to truly see the Ten Commandments in the schools, go volunteer. Go live out the Sermon on the Mount. Be meek, merciful, peaceful. Love your neighbor as yourself. And I think that will make a much bigger difference. Muslim countries, what it's like to do evangelism, what it's like to be a missionary. Sometimes on the part of the missionary, great sacrifice. Also did my MBA at Vanderbilt, and I'd always wanted to be a missionary. Part of the reason for getting my MBA was to go to the Soviet Union. At the time it was closed, you couldn't go, so I couldn't just say I'm a missionary in the Soviet Union. So I wanted to either start a business or to teach, and so I graduated with my MBA. People are going into, you know, corporate finance and accounting, and I'm like, I'm going to be a missionary. And I made $9,000 my first year out of my MBA, and that was money I had to raise. So it's kind of funny, actually. But then, you know, just being a missionary, I know a lot of people and a lot of missionaries have suffered far worse than I have, but you end up missing birthdays, funerals, weddings. We sometimes encountered unique threats. I have had people try to kick in my door twice while I was inside. I've had weapons drawn. I had a guy pull a hatchet on me one time. Literal death threats. We received literal death threats. Been interrogated by a government. Been sick a ton, more days than I can count. But again, there's people that have suffered far worse than I have. Being a believer in a Muslim country, I can't speak to being a Muslim background believer, but I can speak to what I've seen. And I've shared my faith with so many Muslims before. And you get to the end of the gospel presentation, like, yeah, I track, I understand what you're saying, I hear you out. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying, but I cannot be a Christian because I am, fill in the country's name that or their ethnicity. I can't because I am Kyrgyz. Because they know instinctively when they do that, they're giving up family, they're giving up citizenship is not the right word, but they're giving up cultural heritage, they're giving up the ability possibly to find a job, a spouse. They're giving up so much more than we realize simply by by saying, I choose to follow Jesus. So in some ways, it's interesting to think the passage that we looked at today, where Jesus is giving these conditions, a lot of times, people that come to Christ in these Muslim countries or other areas, and in the U.S., I'm sure there's situations in the U.S., I'm not saying that's not the case in the U.S., but I'm just saying I saw it more in Muslim countries, is that they in some ways come pre-qualified to following Jesus. If you don't mind, bring up this next slide, note number 6. It says, we can't be a follower of Jesus until we've died to self. So I wanted to clarify something. So I mentioned that, you know, in some ways it feels like maybe Muslims are pre-qualified to follow Jesus better. And in many ways, that can be true, because you see a lot of Americans, you know, sitting in a church for 30 years, and they're no more mature than they were 30 years ago. Whereas you see a lot of Muslims like, hey, I've counted all these types of costs. I'm fully on board. And they just grow so rapidly. But let me be very clear about this. And this is where the playing field is equal between Americans or Muslims or Germans or Chinese, is that everyone has to die to self. So they may have more, like in Muslim countries, more upfront costs that they pay, but they still have to die to self daily just like we do. And so here's one of the things I wanted to bring out. Just because you have to give up a lot, that does not exempt us from the condition to denying ourselves and taking up our cross. So can you imagine the astronauts coming into the elevator and they're like, to this fireman, like, hey, you know, it's not Halloween for 4 more months. No, they knew what they were getting into. And as I had mentioned earlier, a number of minutes ago, there's good news on the other side of this. And the reason Jesus is drawing this line on this in the sand is because he does not want us to miss out on something that is beyond our wildest imagination. He doesn't want us to miss out on what's truly in store for us. And he's trying to save us from ourselves. So what's fascinating to think about is everything you wanted, everything we wanted to hold on to, like if we're on the front side of that challenge of Jesus to deny ourselves and take up our cross, everything that we would want to hold on to or gain by not denying or carrying our cross is actually lost anyway if we don't do it. Take a look at this in the next slide. Jesus says, for whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and the gospel will save it. And that's such a radical concept of discipleship that most of us in the West don't really grasp the depth of it. Take a look at this note. It's the next fill in the blank. It says, Jesus is not talking about a works-based salvation, though. You're thinking, okay, now what do I need to do? I need to quit doing that sin. I need to give more money to the church. I need to, you know, go serve at an old folks' home. No, that's not the point Jesus is making at all. It's not about doing more. It's about letting Jesus take control. So he's talking about entering into the abundant life that God has in store for us. You know, when we look at the idea of the cross, it's not where Jesus is saying, go and die and then come serve or follow me. I want to read a verse that I think will maybe help. I hope it helps clarify a little bit of this. So what does it even look like? You know, taking up a cross, like, hey, that sounds stupid. What does it look like? Same exact passage, but in Luke. Jesus is speaking. It says, then Jesus said to them all, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily to follow me. And so there's never this assumption or expectation that we're even supposed to put it down. Jesus didn't say, deny yourself, take up your cross, go die, and then follow me. He's saying, no, you got to carry it. It doesn't matter if you became a believer when you're 10 years old and you're 90 years old. You still have that thing lugged and strapped to your back. And that is how we follow. We follow Jesus. It's a lifelong endeavor. And, you know, as we're thinking about this and looking at it, we're probably not excited. I mean, we're not, you know, we're probably not excited about dying to self or carrying a cross. And, you know, frankly, we're going to suck at it. We're going to be miserable failures at doing it at times. What I found interesting as I was reading this and, or preparing this and thinking, yeah, this does not sound like fun evangelism or it does not sound like fun life. Think about what Jesus did. So look at this passage from Matthew 26. Jesus was literally about to die. He was literally about to carry that beam, his cross, as an example of what he's talking about. And he says this, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." And he repeated that three times. If you remember the passage or another passage, he prays, he goes back, the disciples, no surprise, are asleep. He's like, oh, okay, great. Then he goes and he prays again. He prays it a second time. Goes back, disciples are asleep. He's literally about to die and his disciples are sleeping on him. And then he goes back and prays it three times. Not even the king of the universe wanted to do the Father's will if he didn't have to. Obviously, he followed through, fortunately, for our sakes. So the point I want, one of the points I wanted to make is note 8, following Jesus is not about doing more for God, it's about living less for yourself. It's letting Jesus be in charge of your life. It's giving him control. And so as we know, the disciples scattered. After they fell asleep and Jesus was crucified, they were out of there. But Jesus in his loving mercy restored all of them. So like I said, we're going to fail at this time. Or this at times, but Jesus in his grace has enough grace to restore us. You know, the message really that he has given us is simple, but it's not easy. And, you know, I also want to make it clear, if you're sitting there thinking, okay, what's my next step? What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to take away, what am I supposed to take away from this? Jesus isn't saying go be a missionary at some country you've never heard of. He's not telling you to be a martyr. He's not telling you to be a hermit. I mean, maybe he is. I mean, obviously get with him and, you know, say, do I need to be a missionary? But that's not the point I'm making. He's not saying, okay, go home. Where do I need to be a missionary or whatever? The opposite, the exact opposite is true. He's not saying go suffer more for me just for the sake of suffering. And there's a real paradox here. One, you know, Jesus wants us to get the most out of life. He doesn't want us to lose our soul. And as I had mentioned before, the very thing that we would want to hold on to by not denying ourselves, not taking up our cross, is actually the very thing that we lose and more. And he's wanting to save us from that. And I know I was chiding and kind of at the four laws in some of the Western evangelistic methods. And they're great. I've used them successfully for many, 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 many years. So I don't want you to think, okay, I can never use those. That's not at all what I'm saying. In fact, bring up this verse again from Law, one of the four spiritual laws. It's note 4 is also up here. It says, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and have it abundantly." And the whole idea, the idea in Greek here is this rich and satisfying life that's beyond the extraordinary, that you think, well, that's what I would have wanted by not denying myself or taking up my cross. And Jesus is saying, that's the only way you get it, is to deny yourself and to take up your cross. And when I was in seminary, I was at Talbot like 25 years ago, our oldest was less than 2 years old. We had just had her, Verity, you may know her. She just got married in January. And that was back in the days when Disneyland, the annual pass was $99. And if you were under 2, it was free. So, and we were like 25 minutes away. And this was going to be Verity's first trip to Disneyland. She didn't know what to expect. She's like, I don't know, 20 months old or something. And so we get there and, you know, drive 20, 30 minutes. You get in, you know, the parking lot, and you go to the little tram to take you to the park, and she's like, whoa, wow. And I'm like, Verdi, Virginia and I, you know, were like, Verdi, this isn't Disneyland. This is the tram to Disneyland. What's on the other side is so much more than you even expect and understand. And that's kind of that line in the sand that Jesus is talking about. There is so much beyond what he has in store for us if we're willing to just deny ourselves and take up our cross. So you may be asking, okay, what do I need to do today when I go home? You don't have to make it complicated. Just ask God where you need to die to yourself. You know, maybe it's a specific thing that you're not willing to give up. Maybe it's a relationship or money or whatever else. I mean, that's between you and him. But you have to be honest and truly humble and say, Lord, where do I need to die to myself? How do I take up my cross daily? I'll bring up, ask the man to come up. One of my favorite books in the Bible is Ecclesiastes. And I've ended up studying it with navigators at my freshman year at Vanderbilt. And I grew up really legalistic and kind of fundamental and so forth. And it's like, whoa, man, this book is insanely helpful. Just talking about enjoying life. And, you know, if you're not familiar with Ecclesiastes, the author more than likely is Solomon. And he's the wisest man in the world. And because he asked for wisdom and he got it. And so he's like crazy, crazy wise. And so he's like, okay, I'm going to really test out life. I'm going to see, okay, what gives me pleasure? And he kind of felt like he had license to do whatever. He had a harem. He could had all this wine. He could do all these projects. He was extremely wealthy. It says in scripture that there was so much wealth that silver was just like stones on the ground. And he had renown. People would come to him and just like gawk at how, one, wealthy he was, and then also how wise and smart he was. Just everything was just over the top, truly just, you can't even imagine how incredible it was. In fact, he says to this about himself, he says, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. And then he comes to this conclusion and says, man, it was just meaningless. And so that's how the book starts. The end of the book says this, now all has been heard, here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And this isn't saying, hey, just go out and, you know, follow the Torah or whatever. This is just saying the whole essence of our being is to know God and to walk with him. And Jesus does not want us to miss that. He drew a line in the sand. He said, if you want that life, you've got to deny yourself and follow me. He wants us to have that life beyond extraordinary.
Hey everybody, it's Britt again. Thanks for listening. If you need something, if you have a question, or you'd just like us to pray for you, you can reach us through email, info@sunridgechurch.org. We hope you'll listen in again next week, but in the meantime, keep helping people find and follow Jesus.